I will read again some of the questions or comments that I wrote down. I woke up late this morning, and immediately there was the feeling of having done wrong, having slept late. Then I realized that here sitting is optional, and I could see more clearly how thought creates badness and guilt, feelings of badness and guilt. Things become lighter when you see what they really are. I feel freer without structure here, but then again I miss the structure here and might I had more of it, I wouldn't have to confront myself directly. Having a prescribed practice has some kind of comfort about it. When I hear about a state of no self or no separation, such ideas and concepts become new goals for me again. I'd rather be open to what is here than become agitated by the goal of selflessness. To me, practice is like falling in love. In this selfless mode of being, being without a self, as so many religions stress, wouldn't one lose one's personality? How would my wife relate to me then? Would I ever say again, "Oh, what a beautiful sunset," to someone who was with me? Do you, Tony, still have a personality? We got to talk about this one. There are so many thoughts almost obsessively occupying the mind, circling on and on and on. No way to stop them. And looking at them hasn't slowed them down, or being aware of it has not slowed them down. What does it mean to look at thoughts? I want to ask something about shyness. I often have a difficult time saying something to certain people, like, for instance, my father or brother. I can, in my imagination, say things to them, but the words don't come when we're together. You say that you don't prepare a script for your talks. How is this possible? Does sitting have to do with insight? What are we sitting for? If it is such an ecstasy, as some people say, why do we sit so little or not at all? Maybe we should say something about sitting with or without structure, and what the people who have brought it up, not just in this retreat, but it comes up in almost all retreats when people who haven't been there come freshly. What is meant is requires sitting. And one has to be there. One has to do this or that. Here we have to do our work and be at mealtime at a certain time, but that's all. One doesn't have to sit. One doesn't have to sit in a certain way. Doesn't have to face this. Well, yes, we have very quite a bit of limitation here on how to space oneself in sitting. But you can turn any which way on the space you have. And the other thing about structure that is talked about or is having an assigned practice, assigned by the teacher. Sometimes one could almost say supervised by the teacher, encouraged by the teacher, and one, before doing something else, one goes to the teacher, and the teacher may or may not change one's practice as he or she sees fit. I guess there are not so many ceremonies and rituals at this place, so that is not something that has come up, but. Well, all of that, people often in the beginning feel the freedom from that when it's not required, when it doesn't take place. A certain elation going on, maybe also with the thought, I don't have to do this, because this thought, I have to do things, is oppressing all of us. I have to do this, I have to do that. And when we don't have to do things and that thought does not oppress, then it's easier to do things, even the very same things. I remember when we first introduced not having to sit, a person came to me and said, you really mean it? I said, yes, you don't have to sit. We asked several times during the retreat. And he said, this is what I've been waiting for. All my spiritual practice, I don't have to sit. But he sat every round. Well, one doesn't know. Is it because there was the freedom to sit? Or as people who have looked at this quite thoroughly and deeply say, great guilt, even in a place where you don't have to sit. The guilt I felt the first time I put my shoes on while other people were taking them off. She was leaving, others were coming in for the sitting. And as people have discovered here and elsewhere, not having a structure such as we're talking about allows to come in touch with one's dependency on it. And after first feeling of freedom, as somebody reported, then there comes a missing of it. Sort of semi-nostalgically looking back to when I had a structure and how much more comfortable it was. There wasn't all of this guilt or uncertainty what to do. Sometimes people say, I think endlessly, should I sit or shouldn't I sit? I wish I was made to sit, then I wouldn't have to decide. You laugh, but it's very real for a lot of people who have lived in this way, not just since they've had a spiritual practice, but this just picks up our patterns and continues them that were already there before we came to such a structured practice. No one in this particular retreat has sort of hassled with me, why don't we have it? And it hasn't happened, but very often it does. People challenge me. Say, everything in life has structure, a leaf has structure, building has structure, why not structure here? Oh, everything has a form, the thousands of forms of flowers, why not have a form here? This to me is argumentation. For the sake of arguing and defending what one is accustomed to and invested in. Because we can argue about it. Well, what we mean by needing a structure. Of course this body has a structure, this chair has a structure. We have a schedule. This talk takes place more or less at the same time every day. Meetings, there's all kinds of structure here. So much so that some people who have heard about it and have never been to anything like a structured spiritual practice feel, why do you have so much structure here? It all depends on where you come from. Everything's relative. Why do people sit together at all, some people say? That's an individual thing. But the real question is, can there be a dawning of awareness of what is going on in the mind this moment of sitting down? Like one person said, I have to really feel I have to confront myself here. I can't take refuge in a mechanical, habitual practice, which I have done. As soon as uncertainty or anxiety comes up, I take my refuge in my practice, using it to keep at bay discomforting or painful thoughts. You find out for yourself. Let's find out for ourselves what our habits are, what our habit structures are. And they're not limited to requirement of sitting. We're almost totally habitual creatures, habitual trains of thought, habitual ways of behaving and reacting, based on past patterns which are stored in the brain and activated or activatable at any time and active at all times. We are constantly reacting from some kind of habit based on what happened to us before and to those who raised us, inculcated us, taught us, educated us, their habits and the habits accumulated in civilization and culture and humankind since time immemorial. There's the whole vast unconscious, as what does Jung call it, collective unconscious, which all of us participate in. The Buddhists call it the storehouse consciousness. Everything that's ever happened and been thought about and done is stored as memory in human consciousness, and we participate in human consciousness. We think and pride ourselves, maybe, on having this individual consciousness which we think is mine. I have developed it. I am the possessor of it, and the controller of it, and the user of it. This is delusive thinking. Consciousness has evolved over thousands and millions of years and is still evolving, unfolding. And as more and more people discover or think about in the sciences, even is that it is not limited to humans and animals, it is also with the rocks and the electrons and space and galaxies and stars. An interrelationship, relating and reacting to each other over distance as though it didn't exist. One electron, millions of light years distant from another one, they're affecting each other, they're related to each other. So, in this consciousness, coming back to the human consciousness, with its unconscious aspects, paths, or those that go beyond one's own personal experience, are causing reactions in us now that we're not aware of, that we think we will, we intend, we want to be this way, we are free-willed. Be a whole subject of thought interested me when I was in my late teens, this whole question of free will. Did I have free will or not? Or was everything predestined? That these seemed to be the two options to me at the time. And we human beings pride ourselves in having a free will. Some of our religious teachings say that God gave us free will to do good and evil. But if we were free, why would we do evil? We do it because we don't know what we're doing. That's what Jesus said when he was dying on the cross. Tremendous pain and agony, thirsty and being given vinegar to drink and poked in the side and taunted for not getting down from there if he was the Son of God. And all he said at that point was, "My Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing." He didn't say, "Forgive them, those poor sinners." It's interesting, he asked his Father to forgive them. Maybe he was a little bit worried what the Father may do to these people. I was worried about, as a child, about this Father. I had my little picture book that I'd come across. My parents did not belong to any particular religion. They were both scientists. But I had this little picture book of Old and New Testament. And I was always interested in picture books. Very, could sort of absorb myself in the pictures of fairy tales and books and really live that stuff. And the pictures of the angry, vengeful, jealous God had me really very worried. You couldn't escape, hide from him. This one picture with a tree and Adam and Eve hiding. But there was no way to hide because he saw right through and saw them. And of course the expulsion from paradise with a huge sword. An angel did it. This really shattered my trust in angels. Oh, there was another picture. The brain can fragment. Another picture in a songbook was about an angel who walked throughout the land taking care of little children. There was a little child lost, or so the picture tried to convey. It was lying in a meadow, not in its bed, lying in a meadow, and an angel sort of standing over it and sheltering it. That picture was very helpful. Not to be that scared. I was a very scared child, of course, growing up in Germany, half Jewish, with the persecution and concentration camps and bombing attacks, and the young men of our generation, most of them not returning. It was a fearful, meaningless, utterly scary time. And there was no help to think of an angry God, punishing God. But this expression of Jesus, "Forgive them because they don't know what they're doing," that touched me very deeply. Although the teaching about Jesus, that he took upon himself the sins and suffering of the world, did not make any sense to me at all, because I felt guilty and full of sorrow and pain and fear, and nothing felt lifted just by hearing or reading or being told that this man had taken upon himself the suffering of the world. And you couldn't discuss it either. The minister was cross when I asked him about it. This is, he You just don't ask those things. You just believe them. You have faith in them. So, coming back to our consciousness, our stored memories, which cause the reactions that we exhibit all the time, reacting so automatically, often very much to our dismay. We didn't want to sound cross at a child, and it's already come out. We don't want to be being numb or tongue-bound with our father or brother, but we can't speak out. We would like to be friendly and kind, and we find we're looking after ourselves first, me first. So, we do like to be told what to do so we feel safe. We don't have to face the guilt of not knowing what we're doing. Even the punishments imposed are maybe easier to take and to, work off our punishments, rather than face the uncertainty of looking out for ourselves. To face anxiety, uncertainty, insecurity, as it manifests in each one of us. And live with it on friendly terms, with the insecurity of not knowing. Not all the time. At times we have to know, and then we do know. We talked about emergencies before, crises. Or in our practical life, we have to make plans, and for here, people who take care of shopping for the retreat and cooking have to have some idea how much food is used by 40 people. They still not have calculated right. People eat more. So you have to plan some more, buy some more. But in our psychological ways, can we face them freshly, not knowing what this all is, but be with the anxiety, be with the angry reaction, or the overwhelming feeling of jealousy that comes up, or greed at times, aggression, violence, and let it show itself, let it have its space to be seen, to be felt and touched and seen and listened to without the intermediation of precepts. We talked about it yesterday, guilt or whatever. And if guilt comes up, can we give some space to guilt and look at it, what it is, what it does, how it arises, how it feels? The body participates in every thought that arises in this brain. And every bodily manifestation which we feel as agitation, oppression, fright, anger, anxiety, all of those give rise to more thoughts. And the thoughts give rise to more sensations, and a lot of conflict arises because we don't want to feel the way we feel due to the thoughts that have crossed the mind, habitual thoughts, unconscious thoughts, cultural thoughts, racial thoughts, personal thoughts. So, in whatever structure or no structure one may find oneself, can one question, habit as it arises, wonder about it, not say, well, this is how things have to be? Then we don't look, then we just keep investing and holding on. The person who brought up being overwhelmed by so many thoughts, not just one person has brought that up. It's very common. It's our situation. Particularly when the outer stimulation abates a little bit, And when one does not hold on to a practice quite rigidly, to cut thought or control by concentrating on the practice, when that is let go for a while, then there are all these thoughts. Some people say the chaos of it all. I don't want to face chaos, but we are chaos most of the time, with all our conflicting desires and fears and wants and ideals and conflicting ideals. We want to be spontaneous, but we also want to be good. We want to be loving, but we also want to look out for ourselves and not get less than someone else. So, this question of what do I do with the overwhelming flow of, constant flow of thoughts, I don't know what to do with it. I have no technique for or against it. But I'm interested in this chaos. I'm interested in what it is that I'm thinking about when I'm anxious. I don't want to just repress it. I've done this all my life. And everybody around me does it. It's a cultural habit to repress things that are uncomfortable, painful, doubt arousing, to establish some kind of tenuous pseudo-security. Let us be friendly with the chaos. And one can see at a glance, as one wakes up from a fantasy, a string of thoughts, as there is a waking up, a coming to, one can see at a glance what it was one was thinking about. Oh, let me get the me and I out of there. One can see at a glance what the thoughts were all about. Or there can be seeing at a glance, at an instant, of what all the thoughts were about. Me, usually about me. Me in the past, me in the present, me in the future. Happy or unhappy, successful or failure. To be intimate with that which is going on in this organism. This is the only place where we really can have some insight into what's going on. We always want to dabble in other people's behavior, diagnose other people's states of mind. And some of us are very good at it, putting our finger on what's wrong with someone else, or what their troubles are, what their problems are, or their neuroses, which is all right, there's a place for it. Why is it so hard to look at oneself openly, defenselessly, non-protectively, to discover what is going on in this, what seems such a chaotic mind? And there's no how to it. It's just as there's a coming to see at a glance what it was that the mind was occupied with, frightened of, or agitated about, at a glance can be seen. Just as you wake up from a dream, at a glance, the whole dream is there, isn't it? You see? And as you talk, it takes time. Talk about it, the different aspects of it, but the whole thing is there. And looking at thoughts does not mean thinking about what we're thinking. It's a very fine discernment. Because that's what usually happens when one hears, look at your thoughts, and what happens is to think about what we're thinking, which is adding to the stream of thoughts. Awareness of it is not thinking about it, it's awareness. Seeing at a glance, see, how one was remembering a past scene of pleasure, or projecting a past scene of pleasure in the future, and also feeling instantly the positive, pleasant energies coming from imagining a pleasant past or future incident. To see that connection between the thoughts of past or future pleasure and the physical response of pleasure energies or whatever all goes on chemically in this body. There are thousands of chemicals circulating in this body, ready to be triggered to transmit information to other organs and stimulate them into action. Body usually works as a whole, in pleasure or pain. And it's so interesting to discover the connection between our fantasies and the state of our body, the feelings, sensations, and then the evaluation, I like this or I don't like this. And if I like it, there's the incentive, more of the pleasurable thoughts to keep on with the pleasurable sensation, like any kind of addiction. We're very worried about addiction to drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, but our prime addiction is to our thoughts and the feelings that they arouse, both good and bad, because we know them, we're familiar with it. To come upon that, to discover it, is an opening. Some light shed, something getting lighter, not the heaviness of sort of feeling victimized, because we never feel victimized by a pleasurable thought. Maybe we do. Maybe we do, if the most pleasure seems to come from being a good practicer, having a good practice and being a concentrated meditator, this may replace some of the other pleasures. This image, I'm doing well, I'm making progress, getting better. So to watch innocently, as it were, not, which means not judging it as right or wrong, good or bad, better or worse. And as there is the interest in discovering about thought, what it's all about, its content, without thinking further about it, just seeing it, its connection with the body, its addictive power, wanting to have more of it or not wanting this, and the body responding to that, manifesting all of that, maybe a conflict, and then the disagreeableness of the conflict and the thought, how can I get rid of it, and the body responds to that again. No wonder we're tied up in knots. We are, most of the time. And then the question comes up, what is the meaning of sitting quietly? Does that have anything to do with insight? Find out. Find out about sitting quietly, not by asking people. 10 people will give you 10 different answers. 10 books will give you 10 different answers. But if you find out for yourself, you don't need to ask people or books. Although I'm not saying that all books are not helpful or that people pointing out something that is so aren't helpful to listen to. If it isn't just a matter of remembering what they say and then repeating it, but looking for oneself whether what is said is actually truly so. So find out about sitting quietly, which normally in our society doesn't happen. You may wait for an hour in a doctor's office, but then you pick up a magazine. Put it right in front of your eyes. So you don't see the other people. You see, the ads and the stories, more of it. Or maybe waiting for a bus. Are we quietly looking and listening, or just dreaming, or getting angry over the bus being late? Can there be awareness while waiting for a doctor's appointment or for a bus? These may be the only times when there's some period in which we don't do anything and don't have to do anything. And often we regret the loss of time. We're wasting our time. Turn that around from wasting time to using that time to listen and look inwardly, outwardly. If it's a chaos that presents itself, then look at that. And looking means not judging it or wishing it away, but glimpsing it for what it is, what it does, what it causes. May only happen in the beginning for brief instants at a time. But the fact that it happens at all, that a human being waking up doesn't just get out of one train into another, is very significant. For a moment, not to know what to do, not to know what something is, but to listen and look freshly, attentively. Like that little newborn baby we were talking about earlier. The baby never feels that its time is wasted. It looks around, it's aware, grabs and licks and pounds, and then it sleeps so beautifully, whole belly moving up and down, not gasping for air, not having a spiritual practice. Sitting has to do with insight? I don't know. Find out. You may sit for 10, 20, 30 years and get very expert at it, but not really have an insight about this attachment to being an expert. There are many layers of motives and imagery in this mind, and to really come upon them needs a very transparent mind which is not fearful of discovery of what we call self-centeredness, which means no image of being selfless or compassionate or this or that, no image, but to discover directly what imagery is there. I mean, no ideal standards set before you. Look, Krishnamurti always used to say, freedom is at the beginning, not at the end. Can one look freely at the beginning, free from all of one's holdings to refuges? Or at least not free, we're not free of it, but we can see our dependency on it. Freely? Without immediately saying, I need it, and if we hear ourselves saying, well, I need that, and we hear ourselves rationalizing it, can we question it some more? To continue with that particular question, if it is ecstasy, as some people say, all right, why don't we sit more? Or not at all? Find out for yourself if you come home from this retreat. Sitting has been at all meaningful for you, may not have been meaningful, then you will maybe not do it again, who knows, or not do it immediately, maybe in a year. Something will come up about quiet sitting. You may want to try it again. But if it has been at all meaningful in terms of getting in touch with things inside and out that we're not normally in touch with when we're so busy with reacting from programs, then maybe you will sit again. Or you will if that question is alive, wonder about the resistance to it. But if we don't sit and we like it, we actually find it helpful and meaningful, and then we don't. And by sitting quietly, I don't mean a certain posture in a certain place, but having some quiet time to oneself in whatever way. Lying down in an easy chair, in a rocking chair, walking quietly. Why does one forget about it? It's an interesting phenomenon. Why does resistance come up against it? Very, very interesting phenomenon, worthy of examining. Let me say here parenthetically, not only interesting phenomena are worthy of examining, everything is worthy of examining. Everything worthy of looking at and wondering about. We talked about boredom in one meeting. So why resisting some quiet time, sitting quietly? A tremendous pull toward activity, isn't there, for a lot of us? Because in activity we feel sort of semi-safe, occupied. The space is very narrow, but at least in this narrow space there's no room for thinking about things about myself that may be bothersome or worrisome or painful. Of course, all of us, and people have told me here, back in the States, Sweden, wherever, everybody's just so busy. So many things to do. One person mentioned when I get some less feeling of pressure, then I think of all the letters I have to still write by the end of this week. And I think, shouldn't I use this time to write these letters? Because I remember when I'm home, the pressure of all the stuff that I still have to hand in or have out in the mail by Saturday. We are overburdened with activity, most of us. Some of us not. Most of us are. And caught in the activity and the pressure of that and more still to be done, it seems to be so meaningful, so important, so consuming. That's the nature of this narrow space of daily activities, to loom as utterly important and significant, that it has this power to exert pressure on the whole body and mind. And then sort of a glancy thought at sitting or spending quiet time, that seems less important, that can wait till the important things are done. And then when the important things are done, then one is so exhausted that one wants to turn on the television or go to the movies or get a video. Do I sound as though I was condemning this? I may sound like that. I'm not. Just describing what goes on for us. And it's true, sitting quietly may not be as relaxing as turning on the television. We come in touch with stuff that happened during the day that one did not pay much attention to, and yet it was recorded and wants to be looked at, almost beckons to be looked at. And when we realize that's why this nervousness is there, or this sort of hidden anxiety, I haven't looked at something that happened during the day, what I said, what I did, or what somebody else did to me or said to me. Now, find out by sitting down in spite of the resistance how it is to be with whatever comes up about the day, or actually sit in the morning. I find that is a wonderful time to sit in the morning, before everything has woken up. Offices are not yet going. We may sense all of these, the waves of these activities. Morning is very still. And if a resistance is there, why not make that one's first inquiry? What is the resistance all about? And relax into the resistance. By relax meaning not I must and I have to, but wondering, freshly, innocently, what is resistance? And then letting go of the concept of it. Because what is going on in this body-mind is not a concept, it's something actual, palpable, audible, feelable, and maybe a connection to certain ideas reveals itself, and one can question the validity of those ideas, that something else is more important or whatever, or that I have no time. Old Zen saying comes to mind, sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows all by itself. The thoughts come all by themselves and they also go by themselves. There's no one, there's no thinker there. Did you ever think about that or look at that? We think we are the thinker, don't we? But it's only a stream of thoughts. Either augmenting, accumulating, or slowing down. Because in this sitting quietly, doing nothing, leaving the mind alone, has a way of slowing down if you give it enough time and patience and space and no pressure to achieve something or attain something or become somebody. That's always doing something and not sitting quietly. I will not forget some of these other questions that I wrote down. We still have two more talks. We'll end here for today.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.